So, okay, I want to welcome our speaker today. I think this is the first time, Mary, that you've spoken at Word and Life, so we're not the first time you've spoken around town, but the first time she's spoken here. So, Harriet Burke has been in this Catholic community for how many years?
Over 40. 1961, yeah.
Harriet and Chuck, her husband, have been important figures in education in this community for well over 40 years, and they worked together. They were the initiators of the whole project to establish a Catholic chair, to endow a Catholic chair at UCSD, amongst the many other things that they have done, a constant presence together. And so this has been a hard year and a half now, I think, since Chuck, who's with us in some way, we can't see, but he's here, is present to us. So they have 5 children, 10 grandchildren, and a great-grandchild on the way.
Yay.
They have a big project going on in their house that I think is going to be on the Discovery Channel, right?
Yeah.
And and they're adding on so that her daughter and is one of your grandchildren also going to be there?
Just
your daughter. Anyhow, she can maybe tell a little bit more about that. So let's welcome and sing our blessing over Harriet.
Talking about the speakers, we were aware of Father Virgil's frail health, and so kind of on an interior impulse, I said, I want to do that, because this book meant so much to me. There were so many things that really touched me deeply, and so, and particularly I would say these three chapters, 6, 7, and 8, really spoke to me in many ways from the experience, particularly that I've had in the last year and a few months since Chuck died. But over the years, I was present for the death of both my parents, which I think was a real blessing. I didn't have the experience I have now of death and dying, but you know, I was just so very grateful that I could be a part of that time of them passing from this life into new life. And then in 2001, my sister she had a very rare form of cancer in her blood cells, and she was the last 2 months of her life she spent at UCLA Medical because she needed transfusion so often she couldn't have care at home. And she had an open wound in her chest from this disease that she had. And it just reminded me so much of Kathleen Fisher's words when I read those in that first chapter. She said something about authentic relationship with the holy leaving the trail, and the trail is compassion. And it just rang so true for me because when she was in the hospital, we were able to go down there and stay with her quite a bit during that time. And so that the nurses didn't have to come into the room, we would go in and we would be with her and we'd dress that wound, which probably sounds just awful on one level. And yet, you know, there was just a holiness and a peacefulness and watching her eyes shine back. I mean, it was always a quiet time. We didn't talk when we did this. And just her eyes shining back, appreciation, was just an amazing time. You know, we probably all have pictures in our home of the Sacred Heart in our lives. And so that image kept coming to me as we were doing that. So it made it kind of a ritual, respectful time. So I do have, a wonderful history of walking a bit with the dying, but it wasn't until my husband Chuck was diagnosed with emphysema that I realized that I was called to a deeper, in-depth commitment of walking with somebody And they're saying goodbye and really walking through death door, to death door with him and thinking, you know, I can't go through and I won't have that touch with him any further. So this morning what I want to say, and I wrote this shortly ago, so I'm going to read part of it, but it pretty much is going to be a personal sharing and not an academic reflection on what this book meant. But I suppose nobody's going to do too much of an academic reflection on this book because it just doesn't call for that. What I loved about this book was the idea of really being mindful of all that's around us, not just in dying, but in all of life, how we're called to that sort of almost an Advent, being an Advent people. You know, we don't know the time, we don't know the place, be on guard. Kathleen Fisher said in chapter one, mystics of every tradition call on us not to focus on secondary matters like visions or blissful feelings, which, you know, sometimes we hear people do, but on how contact with the divine transforms the person's life. And from my own experience, I just call that mindfulness. I think Thich Nhat Hanh uses those words. I also, Eckhart Tolle, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his name, Tolle or Tolle, he called it awareness. Barbara Marks Hubbard, who was here last week, I think she calls it living in the now. Many people use that term. But whatever we call it, I think that there's just great gifts and great graces that come from being fully mindful of what's going on in our life, that all of our life is worth reflection of how God is in everything that we do. And, you know, probably we should live our life this way all the time, that kind of intense mindfulness. I find I don't do that. I can be a part of it for a while, and then it's and in Chuck's dying, I know we would really, really be with it and really try to be mindful of what was going on, but then we'd have to step back and take a breather in a way. I don't know, maybe it's just gathering ourselves for what's to come. The other part of this, I know that in so much of our this time, last time of Chuck, I was so aware of so many signs of the Holy all around us, particularly and what I call the angels that God gave to me or put in our path during that time that helped him and helped me and help our family go through what was really quite a difficult time. So probably for me, the most important part of chapter 6 was that whole idea of community of friends. When Chuck was told after some years of suffering with emphysema and lung disease, the doctors told me he wasn't going to be able to turn this around. And I went into it just a deep funk over that. It was just a really hard time. I was really mad at God. I was mad as heck at Chuck for having been a smoker and not doing the things that he should have done, probably, or at least I thought. And I thought, you know, this is unfair. He's such a good man, and he's done so much for me and for our family, and it just didn't seem right. And, but probably most of all, I was just really scared. You know, what was I going to do without this man I've lived 50 years with? And I didn't know what to do with that anger, except to feel frustrated and really crabby. Didn't do me any good, didn't do anybody around me any good. And Chuck was kind of in a similar spot. At that point, he was on a respirator at home, a big tank that sat on the floor, and he had a long line of oxygen. And many of you have been at the house and saw him in that situation. And he had this long line so he could go all over the house. He wasn't restricted to one room or anything. But the line would get caught on a chair, or I would step on it as he was walking. And, you know, it kind of would jerk his head back. And so swearing was kind of a thing that was going on at this time. Probably from him, but for me too. And the frustration in our life was just always palpable. So it was a hard time. And right around that time, I went to a women's conference at the Casa de Maria. And it was the Casa out on Madeira before they sold it. And two of my daughters went with me, Kathy and Mo, and it was just a great highlight, a great conference. And two of the highlights for me were that at lunch one day I said to the girls, oh my gosh, there's Ginny Cashman over there. And I'd known Ginny for a lot of years, not real closely, but knew her and respected her. And I remembered, I was telling the girls, gee, when her husband Jim died many years before, they did some amazingly wonderful things with Jim that were innovative and helped them to really connect with what was going on and to ritualize what was going on. So I decided I better find Jenny. This was just providential that we were both together at this conference. And so any of you who know her know that when I said to her, Jenny, could you help me? She said, oh, I just love Chuck. He's such a teddy bear. And of course the answer was yes. So the conference also had some wonderful rituals, and that's also something I really appreciated in this book, and I hope all of you have had a chance to read those rituals at the end of the chapters and to take some time with them. Maybe if you don't have time to actually do them, but just to read through them and realize that there's a time for you when the time is right to reflect on those. But at this conference, the theme was fire. And the leader, during a prayer time, invited us to take a look at things in our lives that we wanted to turn loose of, things that were keeping us from being connected to God in our lives. And so during this ritual, she asked us to write down, you know, a word or a phrase or something that, on the small slip of paper, what was it that was keeping us from being connected to God? And what was it we wanted to turn loose of? And so we did that and wrote it. It was a nice piece of paper, and we rolled it up, and she gave us some red ribbon to tie it with. But it was evening time, and a dark May evening, and so about 60 of us, we processed out of the conference center and out into a great stand of trees there, and they had this huge bonfire, just gorgeous. And so she invited us. She said, you know, after some prayer and reflection time, she said, and come forward, any of you who feel called to do that, come forward and just throw this paper onto the fire, and you can say something if you like. And so after a while I did. I went up and I said, and she had told us, be aware of the sounds and what's happening around. And so I did go forward and I said, I want to turn loose of my anger and frustration with God for my husband's illness. And of course, tears choking my voice. And just then, I mean, I hadn't gotten the words hardly out of my mouth, and this huge wind just blew through the trees. So much so that people went, ooh, you know. And so then the leader said, Harriet, did you hear that? I did, and I thought of Pentecost. And certainly was seeing the Spirit was with us during that time. So soon after the conference, Ginny began coming to our house to work with Chuck. She does a process, and I know a lot of you in this room have done it with her, called PRH, and it's a process of talking, of writing, but getting in touch with your interior and your feelings and your emotions and what that means for you and what that means for your body. So she talked to Chuck and encouraged him to talk about, you know, what this all meant for him, this, what were his concerns about dying. And he hadn't been told yet that he was dying, but it was clear that his life was getting shorter. And what did it really mean? What did dying mean? What were his concerns and what were his hopes about all this? And sometimes I was invited to sit in with them, to spend this time with them. And we kind of formed this great bond of trust, I think, through all of this, and realized that our culture doesn't do so good on accepting death. or understanding death, or we do pretty good on denying it and trying to pretend it isn't there. So through this conversation, we decided that it would be really good for us to try to find new ways that we could accept this dying of Chuck's and try to learn and grow from it. So after a few months of meeting, Jenny said to Chuck one day, "What do you think about having a ritual at the house with your family? And just have a chance for the kids, because, you know, nobody knows what to say when you know somebody's dying. You come in and they, you know, do nice visits, but nobody says, 'So what's it like to be dying?'" We don't talk about the elephant in the living room, you know. It's just, and the kids were kind of the same way. I mean, it's like, "Oh no, Dad isn't dying." Well, he was. He was dying. And so I thought this was a grand idea that she had. And so I called all of the kids and all the ones that are here in town and grandkids and asked them if they'd like to come. And Jenny said she'd facilitate it. And so kind of how it went, Jenny talked about her husband Jim and how they did this process with him as he was dying. And then how all of them found that they said, tried to say the things to Jim that were important to say and give Jim the opportunity. Because I think we don't do it the other way either. We don't allow the person dying to say, give them the opportunity to say what they need to say. We're so busy pretending it isn't happening. So she told them that Chuck's, you know, doctor hadn't said to him, "You're going to be dying next week" or anything like that. But it was clear that he didn't have a lot of time left. So Chuck talked a little bit about how it felt to have this disease and his frustrations and fears, and but also was able to say to him how much he loved each one of us and how important we were, and how anybody would have to be an idiot to want to leave this grand family. And then I talked a bit about this frustration I'd been going through, and but also how important. But you know, even on that evening, I do remember saying that I was so holding on to the fact that I wanted it to be perfect. I mean, why could I just turn loose of that? I mean, just let whatever happens happen. But that kind of control that we have sometimes, that want to make things perfect instead of allowing God to make it perfect, you know. And so anyway, Jenny had a spoon, really unusual spoon she brought that evening, we gave it to, as the person talked, they held the spoon. So it was clear that others weren't to interrupt or to bounce off of, but as the person held the spoon, they could either talk or not talk. They could just, you know, be present. And before it all happened, Jenny had said, "You watch." We weren't sure whether to invite all the grandkids or, you know, what level you stopped. And so the youngest is 4. And Jenny said, "Oh no, absolutely. You know, anybody that wants to come should come, and the kids should be there, whether they're crawling around or, you know, being noisy or whatever. Just that's what we're about as family." And so this talking spoon, she said, "You'll be amazed when you hear what some of the kids have to say." And I was. She would use the scripture, you know, "And a small child will lead them," particularly two of one was 9 and one was 11, just, you know, with tears streaming down their face, had just some really insightful things to say, particularly at the end when we closed with a prayer. And Ryan, who was 11 at the time, Jenny said, "Ryan, would you like to do a closing prayer?" And he said, "Well, this may be off the subject, but the Puritans used to say that everybody has a divine spark in them. And I think my grandfather's divine spark is his anger and his frustration, but also his sense of humor." Because Chuck always had a story for everybody and always liked to make people laugh. But, you know, this whole ritual thing was such a rich experience that there were tears, there was laughter, there were pauses, there were silences, but so clear that we were in the presence of the Holy, that we'd allow that to happen, and by letting go of the fear of what might be if we, you know, spoke of the words death. And it kind of takes me back to that first chapter where Kathleen said that part about every tradition cautions people not to focus on secondary matters that I already quoted, like visions or blissful feelings, but how that contact with the divine transforms our life. And it was a transforming time for us. That evening, I think, was the beginning of, I think we're on the threshold of moving into another spot to be able to talk more fully about where we're going and to be more open. One of the people that had so impressed us over the years was Cardinal Bernardin of Chicago. And remember when he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and decided to die publicly and kept people informed about what was going on with him. So I think he was an inspiration to us to kind of keep that awareness there. But if you're in this spot or when this time comes for you, I really encourage you to consider rituals, because they are they're simple to create and they can be whatever they need to be for you. I remember a few years ago when I was working at St. Mark's as a pastoral associate and campus minister, we had our CIA, and we used a book with a written by a priest from Berkeley Newman. It was never published, but in that he always had rituals at the end of every class. And he had this whole layout. He'd draw pictures of how we wanted it to have it and with all the environmental stuff that we were supposed to use. And we never explained them. And I think that's a key thing, because we would tell people, go out and touch the things, and after the prayer was over that we had at the end of the evening. And then the following week, we'd always say to people, what did the ritual mean to you? How did it speak to you? And I'll tell you, I was just always blown away by insights that people had, things that touched them that we, never planned or never thought to plan, that maybe a butterfly, maybe a candle, brought back a memory of something from childhood, somebody in their lives. So that power of the spirit, I think, touching us through prayer and ritual is so important. It's such a rich experience. It kind of happened to me reading the tail end of chapter 6. I don't know if you remember that, but I could just almost smell the incense. Mm-hmm. And hear the clank of the burner that you incense with, and how they incense the casket. And thinking back to being a young child and black vestments and somber songs, and she closed that chapter with, "May the angels lead you to paradise. May the martyrs come and welcome you and take you to the holy city, the new and eternal Jerusalem." I mean, it's just, there's so much that's in ourselves from, our past that I think rituals can call forth. In chapter 7, Kathleen talks about kinds of presence and absence and words from the other side. And that was probably the richest chapter for me, I think. And in it, she talked about dressing, her niece dressing that her sister after she had died. And that's something we were able to do with Chuck. I think our prayer all through his illness was that he would be able to die at home, and he did. I had fallen back in April, just a month before Chuck actually died, and I just did a major number on myself. I had bruised and bloodied and broke my wrist, and so I had a cast on. And this is a disaster, because I was a major caregiver for him, and it was clear that he really was not in good shape. And so who would help him get dressed in the morning, but more importantly, who would help him go to bed at night because that was his hardest time of day. Somehow or other, putting his head down, I don't know whether it was that chest flattening or what, with when he went to bed, but we had begun giving him some kind of medication to relax him before bedtime and just to help him, give him some comfort. And even in that, I mean, there's just the different thoughts. I know that, Anita, when you were talking about nursing care, for the different thinking between the medical community and the hospice community, you know, that the doctor was really against us giving Chuck this medication a half hour before bedtime. I just thought it would make a difference in his lung capacity. And when I said that to the hospice woman, the nurse that came every twice a week, she said, you know, we're in the comfort care here. We're not trying to bring him back to better health. He's already been told that at this point, then he had been told that he was dying and to get his affairs in order. And after we made two middle-of-the-night runs to the emergency, then we decided, you know, it's time for, we won't do this again. It's time for hospice care. So then it advanced to that, to where this one evening that we were giving him morphine. And I tell you, that just, seeing it sitting on the shelf, knowing there was a time when we'd be using it, just made me cry to think that we would get to that stage, and then we got to it. And but then again, the hospice woman said he could drink that whole bottle and he wouldn't overdose. That this is again something to relax him, to give him comfort, and to allow him to sleep. So since I was kind of out of the loop at this time, my daughters began to come and take turns to stay the night with us so they could help us with this evening care. And I'm realizing that as I'm talking, a lot of you don't know Chuck or didn't know Chuck, and you're probably envisioning a feeble old man. Well, probably in some ways he was old, but he was never feeble. We went on vacation 2 weeks before he died, and you know, we did lots of things. Tom Heck pushed him around campus at a conference in a wheelchair the week before he died. Catholic Studies was having a conference, and so he was a man that, you know, lived as fully as he could right up to the last. And on this particular evening that he just couldn't seem to make things work, and would sit up and lay down and sit up and lay down and would say, I'm not going to make it. And so we began to call the girls to, I have four girls that live here in town, well, one in Buellton, and we began to call them and said, you know, things are not looking good, you probably want to come over. And some are only like 2 minutes away. The furthest one is probably 20 minutes away. And they were all able to get there, I think, before he actually died. And some were saying to him, don't go, Dad, don't go. And, you know, others were saying how much they loved him. But at some point during that time, you know, I think he did die. I don't even know when it actually happened, but someone must have began to make phone calls because the room began to fill in with other members of the family coming in and kind of quietly standing around the room. It's kind of an ethereal moment, how things just moved on and how they changed. But once I realized probably everybody that was going to come was there, I called my son in Hawaii, the only child that's not here in California, and, you know, sat down by Chuck and said a prayer of thanksgiving for him, for his life, and what he's been to all of us, and kind of reminisced about all that we had, and then we began telling stories, and I don't even know how long that lasted. As I said, it was probably in the middle of the night sometime, and someone said, I think it's time to prepare Dad, and so someone got washcloths, and Elijah, my oldest grandson, got a candle and brought it into the bedroom. And it's funny, the women were the ones to wash, Chuck, you know, washed his arms and his legs and chest, and kind of a fragrant balm of love and care for. And the men kind of stood, you know, they looked back on. It seems like the men were standing guard on this time. And then it was time to dress him, and the grandsons were the ones that decided, so I guess we all did, who would dress, what should he wear for this time, what would be appropriate. Well, he was a blue jeans and a Hawaiian shirt back, so that seemed right, you know, that for this final trip away, that's what he should wear. And, you know, there's a bit of levity in all of this, too. Somebody said, well, I think we ought to put some M&Ms in his pocket. We did. But then we called, you know, then the mortuary came, but it was just like, there was no plan, there was no, it just kind of evolved, it just kind of happened. And so we, when they came and took him away and took him in the hearse, we all walked out to the street in the morning light. It was probably the breaking of dawn, and as the car went down the street, and we could see the red tail light. Nathaniel, who's probably 23, I guess, at the time, said, it's a Ford. So Fords have been involved in the Fords who are here in town for years, so we kind of smile through our tears on that. This chapter also talks a bit about words from the other side. I think that must be chapter 7. I didn't write that down. And the first few months after Chuck's death, I felt just absolutely numb, and I know so many of you in this room have gone through this experience too. But whenever anybody talked to me about feeling Chuck's presence or remembering something about Chuck, it was just such a balm for me to have that that memory brought up. And the priest that preached at his funeral has said, God is everywhere in our belief, and Chuck is everywhere, so we should pray to him. So, on Chuck's birthday, which was just a month after his death, the family all got together, and we were just reminiscing, and Nathaniel, the same one who saw the Ford leaving the house, said, you know, I've never told you this story since Chuck died, since Grandpa died, he said. He said, that night when I went to bed after Grandpa died, it was about 5 in the morning, and he had this dream. And he's given to really vivid dreams, and he remembers them. I'm not good at remembering them, but he said, this in the dream, we were all in our dining room and talking, and Chuck was trying to get our attention, and this was often the case. We were all too busy talking, and he was trying to tell us something. And so he turned to Nathaniel, and he said, you tell him. And for each child, he had, you know, two or three lines that were so, just captured that relationship between them. And he ended up, I won't tell you all of them, but to kind of get a flavor of how this happened, of words from the other side, he said, and finally, Grandma, he said, you turned his world upside down the moment he met you. And he never lost that exhilarating feeling. And he said, you hope you know that even though his body fails you, his love never will. Mm-hmm. And were those words from the other side. That was just such a gift. And I'm so glad that he'd held that for a while, and I'm glad he decided, because he said, you know, maybe these are all just hokey things, the things we think maybe we shouldn't say. And I'm so glad he did. probably 4 months after Chuck's death, I went to the Casa de Maria, the one where I am right now on retreat. I've been with Barbara Marks Hubbard since Monday, and so kind of broke the retreat to come down here. But if you've never been there, it is just a beautiful place. And I went to what was the big house, the stone house there. And it's really lovely. They have probably 6 or 8 bedrooms there, and they have their own cook at the place. And I just thought this was a good time to get away and to really try to have some quiet and to listen and to try to internalize all that had been going on. And it's just a perfect setting. And just before I had gone, I was talking to the grief counselor at hospice, and she said to me, "Where do you think Chuck is?" And I was absolutely baffled because I had no idea. Mm-hmm. You know, Kathleen said in her book, if you've read this chapter, people said, "Where are you? Mm-hmm. Where are you?" I knew what we'd been taught as mm-hmm. children. Chuck's in a better place. He's with God. He's in heaven. And what more could I want for him? And I repeated all that to Mary. I said that to her. But as I said it, it just had a hollow sound to it and didn't ring true. And but I didn't have any proof of where he was. He hadn't come back to me and said any things to me in the middle of the night. And so this time at the Casa was really a questioning of what do I really believe? What's important? And what is the hereafter that we talk about? So this room I was in, and one of the things that came out of this was really had a pastoral setting, had a view of a really large area of grass and a huge oak tree out beyond that I called the Tree of Faith. Maybe they called it that, and that's why I called it that. I'm not sure. But in my solitude, I kind of wrote a poem about this healing view that I saw outside my window. The Tree of Faith looks in my window, calling me to partake of life. The calling is soft, it's almost inaudible, but it makes me want to run in fright. Is faith within this shell, I ask, or am I hollow, empty, and bare? When Chuck walked strongly by my side, things were clear, there was no need for despair. Which way do I turn? The journey is unclear. To whom do I speak? I can't seem to see or hear. All around me is strange. Mostly things seem awfully bleak, uninteresting and lackluster. Is there no one I can seek? My tears, though one, give me no comfort. Where are you, God, I speak? You are as remote as Chuck in this ugly game of hide and seek. Just probably a couple of months after Chuck's death, many of us went to Maui to visit our son and also celebrate our daughter's 50th birthday. And she'd been talking about this before Chuck's death. And he kept saying, "Go ahead and go. I'm not going to die while. I won't die while you're gone." He died before. So anyway, Kathy was afraid that if she did plan it, that she wouldn't get trapped over there and not be able to get home. But after he died, we decided, let's do go. Go ahead. But I was encouraging them, and they said, "No, you've got to go too." During the same time, and the time that I fell, I had been going to an acupuncture man named Bernard Unterman, and also a man in his office came once a month to town, and he was a chiropractor, but not your run-of-the-mill kind of guy. The first day I went to him was the day I fell, and he knelt down beside me and looked me right in the eye as he worked on me. And it was clear that he was praying, you know, and not in some kind of fundamental way that wouldn't work for me. It was something that he was just trying to be mindful of what was happening and trying to tune into what was going on with me. He later told me that he saw angels flying all around the room that day. And, you know, I don't know what that means, but I love the image. But both of these men became amazing figures for me during Chuck's illness and after he died. And when I told them I was thinking of going to Hawaii, they really encouraged me to go and to take advantage of the beauties of nature and the water and the mountains. And particularly, they both said, be sure you swim every day and take advantage of the healing waters of the ocean. And I followed their advice, and nature was really good to me. My son who lives in Maui, you know, of course knows all the good beaches to go to, so that was really good. And so he took me to Turtle Bay, and I swam with turtles. This is something I'd never done before, and so it was just, a real time of just an expansion of what nature is and how richly blessed we are by having the sort of thing that brings God's presence to life for us. On page 66, Kathleen talks about belonging fully to the universe, and it's a part of that, but another part that we did while we were over there, one of my grandsons was in Bali, I think it was, when Chuck died, and so he had no cell phone access, and he didn't know Chuck had died. And so that was another thing that we wanted to do while we were there, to have some kind of ritual. None of my kids are really much in the way of churchgoers, but so it seemed like this could be a real time to really have another kind of service. They were all at his funeral service that was wonderful for me, and I think for the children. But we wanted this evening to be something that we could ritualize. And so my son works for a company that has a big boat, and we borrowed it that evening and took it out. And as we drove along, there's I think about 15 of us, and dolphins left in front of the bow. And it's just, to me, it was a symbol of the fullness of life and joy and kind of being regenerative. And so we took this boat to a place that really isn't off the beaten track. We could just see a hotel right off on the shore there. But it's a place called Black Rock, and a place where tourists and natives like to jump off. There's like three levels of rocks you can jump off into the ocean. And So at the top, if you walk to the site from above, it's a sign that describes the place as a place where the spirits, where people jump into the spirit world. And the leaders of the Hawaiian community were noted as leaders if they could jump into the water without making a splash. So it was all this kind of historical, spiritual stuff that was around that site. So we stopped there, and I read a poem and read a scripture reading, and we had a Guinness with a beer, and passed it around, and as people would take a sip of the beer, they'd tell a story about Chuck, and I had brought some of Chuck's ashes with me. And it seemed appropriate to have part of Chuck's ashes there scattered where the Maui Burks live, and that seemed like that was would be a rich thing to do. And nobody talked or planned about it, but Dana, my daughter-in-law, brought flowers, and we scattered flowers after we scattered the ashes. So when Kathleen talked about the energy that bursts galaxies, our families, and all other beings, it seemed like that kind of a moment. There's a rich, powerful connection. A lot of what Barbara talked about last week, of that whole connection with all of creation, and being one with the universe. And then she had some words. I wasn't supposed to talk about chapter 9, but there was something in there that just struck me. I wanted to throw in the reminder that experiences are not static, certainly God is not static, but the divine matrix is dancing and singing and ever bringing towards fresh creations. So that struck me about memory, and my oldest grandson wrote on his blog the night of Chuck's death, I want to close with this, surreal. Was called away 3 hours ago to join my family in bathing and dressing my dead grandfather. Thinking that I'll remember the stage that follows denial. If you never got the chance to meet him, which I believe is most all of you, you would have liked him. I'm pretty sure that any traits I have towards kindness and caring came from him. Towards the end, the doctors made him stop drinking Guinness. Which more than anything is what I'm convinced killed an Irishman.